Hello and welcome to the shortest history of Britain. In this podcast, we're going to try to cover a few thousand years of this fabulous nation from the very beginning of life here all the way through to the 20th century. Now, we'll have to skim the surface a little to get through it all, so don't worry about remembering all the dates and the strange names. We're on a whirlwind tour and there's no time to get caught in the weeds. Tonight, we'll be covering the first part of the ancient history. Now, we're all familiar with the arrival of the Romans, the Saxons, the Normans, and we'll come to that. But what happened before that? Where did our people first come from? Were we always an island? Well, in the next 20 minutes or so, I'll take you through all of it, all the way up to the Roman invasion, which would lead into effectively the second chapter of our nation's history. I am Mark L. Watson, and this is the shortest history of Britain. So let's go back to the very beginning. Anywhere up to, and likely above, about 100,000 years ago, Britain was in what we term the Last Glacial Period, which is more commonly referred to as the Ice Age, or the most recent of the Ice Ages. Now, as we came out of the Ice Age, which was around 10,000 years ago, so we're looking at it being about 8,000 years BC, I know a lot of historians these days would rather use BCE, before current era, though it's second nature for myself to use BC, so that's what I'm going with. Forgive me if it's not your thing, but we'll be going with BC from here. So from about 8,000 years BC, much of the coastline, the geography, the geographical landscape, the topography of our country was being formed. A couple of thousand years later than that, I told you we were going to move quickly, in about 6,000 years BC, huge landslides in what was Mesolithic Norway caused these enormous tsunamis from their inland lakes to flow outwards, waves possibly 30 feet high or more. The land that they hit as they flooded outwards, which would become Britain, they hit with such force that that water pushed its way some 25 miles or so inland, and the sitting water that remained became the North Sea. Likewise, they flooded out to the south, and at the south of the country of that we have now, there were vast marshlands, and when the sitting water hit them, that became what is now the English Channel. So from that moment, Britain, as it would become thousands of years later, was an island. Now, the country, the land that we're on, had been inhabited by people on and off from as early as 900,000 years BC, though temperatures were going up and down, we were coming in and out of ice ages, and those varying temperatures, those varying climates, led to the population going up and down across the various millennia. With us not being an island until that point, or certainly had not been for a long, long time, there existed land bridges between what is now England and what is now continental Europe. So the populations of those early humans, our early inhabitants, were actually able to travel backwards and forwards off the land that we have now into Europe and back again accordingly. Archaeologists have found early flint tools in Norfolk, which are some of the oldest human artifacts that have ever been found in Britain, left by those people, those early predecessors of ourselves who would have lived on the land at the time and passed backwards and forwards when those land bridges existed. The land has been continually inhabited here since around 9,000 years BC, which is what we would know as the Mesolithic era. And since that time, this land, which would become Britain, as I say, has had people living here continuously ever since. So the sea levels have gone up and down. They've risen to cut off the island and then gone down again. The land bridges have been rejoined. And then in about 6,500 years BC, they rose for the final time, and we were cut off once and for all, creating the island of what would become Britain. At that point, the people who lived here were largely considered to be modern humans in the best sense, in the scientific sense. We're looking at Homo sapiens. Now, evidence shows that these early humans were employing techniques such as selectively burning areas of forest, for example, which is what covered most of the landscape of the country, in order to create pockets, clearings, pastures, where they could gather animals for hunting. We're hunters and gatherers by nature, and they would have used weapons, of course, to hunt, such as javelins and slingshots, mainly projectile weapons, though they would have had spears constructed from stone and wood, stone knives too. Land was cleared for crops and farming. These people grew barley, wheat, bread would have been made, early bread. Sheep, pigs and cattle were gathered and grazed and contained for food and clothing, such as from their wool, their hide, their leather. Now, this was in what was the Mesolithic era. And after the Mesolithic era came what we would call the Neolithic era. And we're looking now at around 3,000 years BC, so about 5,000 years or so ago. A time of great development, really, versus the years that had preceded it. If we look across to Mesopotamia, which is now modern-day Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Syria, there were great developments in things like mathematics, astrology, astronomy. They were developing things like the potter's wheel, which allowed them to construct jugs and pots for cooking, for transporting water. The sailboat was first developed. Of course, the oar boat, the rowboat, was much older than that. Sails were also used around this time in Egyptian culture, which was also the time of the first hieroglyphs. So we've got this development going on, certainly elsewhere, that would gradually start to find its way onto our land. We've got evidence from that sort of time coming out of Egypt of the development of things like musical instruments. We've got the flute, the harp, the lyre, the clarinet even. It was also the time of the first numerals. We'd had counting techniques as old as man. We've always had the ability to count on our fingers and toes. But written numerals and counting systems that went beyond 10 or 20 were new. So when we think of this ancient time, thousands of years ago, it's easy to fall into the trap of believing that these were very primitive, basic, quite tribal people. But actually, what needs to happen is we need to give consideration to these great developments that were coming out at the time that were not only great developments for their time, but actually a lot of them have not changed vastly between then and now, which of course is some 5,000 years, which gives testament to the minds of the people at the time. Now, the people of Britain at that time may have just been chasing deer around the woodlands with sticks and flint knives, but globally, the human people were developing quickly, and it would soon hit our shores. So, back in this pre-Britain, we were reaching the Bronze Age, which was around 2,500 years BC, and metal workers were able to construct weapons and tools and cooking implements from bronze and copper instead of just from simple stone. Religion as we know it started to come to the front at that time. Now, it's very difficult to define religion and its origins, and frankly, that could become a podcast unto itself. But it is clear that at that time there was the beginning of ceremony and a belief in a greater power. We have stone circles springing up from around that time in places like Castlerigg in Cumbria in the north and Avebury and Stonehenge in the south. Now we also, around this sort of time, we start to see a rise in certain individuals being put into positions of power in society. So those who had great expertise in hunting or warriorship were given these positions of control. Settlements began to spring up which were more permanent and less transient in nature than our living had been prior to that point. And around these settlements, agriculture grew. And till around 1500 years BC, the first towns and villages were being formed. These permanent settlements where architectural evidence could be found to show how people lived. It began to allow for a growth in modern society. Also at that time, something very important happened in terms of trade and in terms of travel. We saw what became known as the Atlantic trade system. Now, this was a culture of metal production and distribution, which linked the lands of Galicia and the Mediterranean, so Spain, up through France as it is now, and into Britain, and then north onwards into Scotland and across into Scandinavia as well. It's characterized by the production and the exchange of things like bronze and copper, bronze axes and swords, spearheads, shields, also things like roasting spits, which could be used to cook meat on fire, flesh hooks for hanging meat, bronze cauldrons and cooking pots. It really linked the nations. And even though this was a time before we'd really taken off to explore the world and before too many tribes had taken off to explore our world, this was one of the first things which enabled that trade across what would become the continent and really laid the path for what was to come. So at this time, we see the first signs of the Celts, who would go on to dominate British culture for, frankly, all the years since, and whose language, or some derivative of it, is still spoken in many parts of Britain, in Ireland and Scotland, Cornwall, Cumbria and Northumbria. These first people, who we termed the Celts, would go on to show themselves again and again on these shores under many names, the Gauls, the Galicians, the Britons, and whose reach would stretch south across the continent to the shores of North Africa. So then we move into the Iron Age, which is in around 750 years BC. So we move into the Bronze Age at 2500, and then into the Iron Age at 750 years BC, where all of a sudden iron replaced bronze as the predominant material of choice for tools and weaponry and utensils. Great Britain had a population at the time of about 150,000, mainly living in small towns. Each would be its own tribe or a sub-tribe ruled by these chieftains, these warlords. Wars and battles between them frequently broke out. And so many began to build these small forts, stone structures on hills or other places of geographical advantage. And if we look back into the historical, the archaeological evidence, it really supports this. It supports that many of these forts were frequently attacked, and it shows just how precarious, how delicate, how rough life was in this land of war. We see, if we look at massacre sites such as Finn Cop in Derbyshire, which dates from around 400 years BC, Danebury in Hampshire, which is just north of Winchester, is about 100 BC. I mean, Danebury, of course, is one of the most excavated hill fort sites in the UK, which has hugely helped our understanding of them. There are around 2,000 hill forts, known hill forts in Britain. Around 600 or so of them are in Wales, I believe. Now, across the seas again, we see a time when the great city of Rome was being founded, and this gave rise to the future Roman Republic, which in turn would go on to be the Roman Empire, though of course we'll get to that. The Egyptian Empire, which had been one of the most predominant global empires at the time, was starting to fall into decline, and eventually fell to Achaemenids in around 525 BC. Greece was also on the rise as one of these new world superpowers, and the wars of Alexander the Great in 336 to about 323 BC eventually brought about the end of the Achaemenid Empire, which was also known as the First Persian Empire. And it took the whole region into Greek hands and Greek control. But only about 100 or so years after that, the Great Battle of Corinth gave the new Roman Republic the upper hand in the area, and it gave them the beginnings of this foothold to conquer the continent and beyond. The beginning of the early world's major cities was starting to show. In the couple of hundred years between 500 BC and 300 BC or thereabouts, we saw the formation of sites which would become Tripoli in Lebanon, Antioch in Turkey, Alexandria in Egypt, Naples in Italy. And in about 400 BC, the first real settlement by the Celts on the site that would eventually become London sprang up. Now, of course, the area had been inhabited by many tribes across the years. But from that point, that site became a permanent location for what would become London, at a location that's thought to now be somewhere around London Bridge. Now, much of England, as it is now, was already very similar to what it would become after the Roman conquest, aside from the introduction of Christianity. Whereas Ireland and Scotland weren't really conquered at all, and were left to develop into a group of smaller kingdoms, more focused on hunting, farming, agriculture, trade in weaponry and in minerals, iron bars, became the early forms of currency. In fact, iron bars were one of the first forms of currency, which allowed this international trade. Of course, it was a global commodity. Britain had this fantastic wealth of mineral reserves that it could draw on. Though soon, coinage was developed using the minerals of the various areas, and mostly bearing the pictures of the local leaders or chieftains from the areas. And it's from these coins that we have perhaps our only record of the rulers of the time. Though the first coins were actually imported from overseas and were used in trade between Britain and Gaul in what is now France in around the 2nd century BC. So this international trade was really starting to grow, and it's around this sort of time that the Silk Road was being opened between Europe and China, and so world trade was starting to become a real prospect as well, and now development was expanding outwards. Other civilizations and cultures from around the world were starting to drip into each other and influence the development of each other accordingly, bringing these great inventions of the time from Europe across into the East, and then from the East back into Europe. Developments in Greece, such as the ability to bind papyrus into a book, gears and levers, and the clockwork mechanism, which would massively influence our ability to create machinery. The boat anchor, the railway system came out of Greece, the catapult. And these minds of Greece, these great minds that we know, were starting to spread the word of science and philosophy and mathematics out to the East as well. We have Pythagoras, Socrates, Herodotus, Hippocrates, Plato, Aristotle, Archimedes, who all lived within that couple of hundred year span between 500 and 300 years BC or thereabouts. Then we also have the early inventions of the Romans, such as windows and central heating systems, the calendar, the road map, the horseshoe, all being taken out to the East. And in turn, the inventions of the Chinese with things like coal mining, the seed drill, the crossbow, were in turn making their way back into Europe as well. Until by about 55 BC, we were producing coins of gold and silver, and they were decorated with king's heads, and I think the first showed a bull on the reverse, which mimicked those early coins of Marsilla or Marseille, or often inscribed with horses, and many with quite abstract and well-gilded, beautiful pieces of art on the reverse of the coin. Now, just as the millennium was about to come to a close, the final card was laid. The Roman Republic, which was well established across Italy, Spain, into France, as well as conquering Greece and the Mediterranean, the Persian Empire, and into Africa, there existed trading relationships between the Celts and the other groups who occupied the British Isles and who governed the various regions ever since Julius Caesar's expeditions over here in 55 and 54 BC. Now, he invaded twice, bringing legions and ships so strong that the British didn't even try to contest them at landing, choosing to allow them to filter inland and disperse slightly before they took them to battle. Now, five of the tribes surrendered to Caesar, but Cassivellaunus, who was a powerful warlord from north of the Thames River in an area thought to be around where St. Albans sits now, had previously been at war with many or most of the tribes of the land, and he'd recently overthrown the king. So upon the entry of the Romans, he was appointed the leader of the rebellion against the Roman invasion. He amassed the great tribes and he kept fort around the town of Wheathamstead in Hertfordshire. But unfortunately, those surrendering tribes who surrendered to Caesar gave away the location of his fort and the Romans prepared to invade. Now, Cassivellaunus sent word to the four kings of the Kent area to prepare an army to fend off the Roman men, but the defence failed, the fort fell, and Caesar and the Romans took the land of Britain. However, they were finding it difficult. There was civil war, there were battling tribes all across the land, and with bitter winter drawing in and the country in this wild, warring state, Caesar was keen to withdraw his troops, to come back out of Britain, to fall back into Gaul, which is now France. So he agreed terms of surrender with Cassivellaunus, who agreed to pay, as part of the agreement, an annual sum, an annual fee to the Roman leader, and in turn would not declare war on them. So Caesar pulled his men back, the Romans fled back to Gaul, and as far as we know, there is no record of any payment ever being made. He wouldn't return again, and the Celtic kings would remain. Now, 10 years later, in 45 BC, Julius Caesar was murdered in Rome on the steps of the Theatre of Pompeii. And it's said that while he wasn't able to take Britain at the time, what he did is he drew attention to it to his successor in Rome and to the Roman generals. It was written by Tacitus that Caesar revealed rather than bequeathed Britain to Rome. Now, after the defeat of Cleopatra and her lover, Mark Antony, at the Battle of Actium, Caesar's adoptive son, Augustus, was granted the power and the title of the first Emperor of Rome, thus ending the great Roman Republic and creating the Roman Empire. Now, a few years later, Caligula amassed his troops, he was emperor at the time, and he reinvaded the land. Still independent, still governed by various factions of the Celtic people. And he largely got nowhere. He landed, but didn't really take the land and eventually fell back. His legions dispersed. And a few years later than that, possibly only a couple of years later, Nero's son Claudius gathered what troops were left from Caligula's failed legions and tried once more. But this time, he took hold of the land that would fall under Roman rule for 400 years. It was a time that would begin to shape modern history in Great Britain and had huge cultural, socio-political, religious, developmental, eventually religious changes on the country for centuries to come. Next time, we examine the period between the Roman invasion and the Norman invasion in 1066. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark L. Watson, and this has been just part of the shortest history of Britain.